Right, let's do it. Okay, Rupert Carline. My name is Darcy Ungaro, and everyone else, you're listening to News of the Money World. Thank you for joining us today. Let's talk about this 50 basis point cut from the Fed. Bit of a surprise move there. I have a few ideas on this, but you know, I know you do as well. So tell me, what have you been reading? What do you think about this one?
Yeah, so for those that have been living in a small cocoon, they might not know that last week the US Federal Reserve, they dropped their basis point, their core interest rate by 50 basis points, so 0.5%. What was really interesting, and we had this debate last week, the market was very kind of split over whether they would go 25 basis point four or whether they'd go all the way down to a 50 basis point four. And I think what's really interesting about it, they clearly chose the extreme. But I guess where I kind of find it fascinating is if we then put it into a New Zealand context, right? The US Federal Reserve, they've decided to drop by 50 basis points. At a point in time, they've got employment at 4.1%. It's very slowly ticking up, not really moving. They've got inflation, which is still above 3%. So it's kind of in that high twos, low threes, depending on who you want, a long way above their 2% target. They've got annual GDP growth that they're expecting this year of about 2%. They've gone and used that data set to create a 50 basis point cut. Let's compare that to New Zealand, where we've done 25. We might do another 25. We will do another 25, but there's very few people talking about 50 or even 75. When we look at our New Zealand data set, New Zealand is currently running, unemployment's now up to 4.8% and climbing pretty quickly. We've got negative GDP growth. We've got inflation at around 3%. We've got government deficit at about 7%, same as the US. I go, why can't we get interest rate relief, and why have they got it so much?
Some of that action. Give us some of that action.
It's kind of one of those two parties has got it clearly wrong, and I don't know which one.
I think maybe they're just operating on autopilot, and they just wait for like the answer to come to them based on what somebody else is doing. Or do you think, because to me it kind of feels like in New Zealand, especially depending on how far back we go, it always feels like the Reserve Bank of New Zealand is behind the eight ball. It doesn't feel like they're actually proactively looking at where we are at right now and making changes fast enough. It feels kind of like they're a bit dopey. Not like they're a bit slow.
I don't know, right? I think that might be a bit harsh. I actually think, reading between the lines, I think one is following true intellectual rigor. The Reserve Bank is going, no, we have to do inflation. We have to do this. We've learned our lessons from the 1970s. We've learned our lessons from the 1980s. We are the world-leading global reserve bank that kind of set up this inflation targeting mandate. And so they're sticking to that. And they're going super hard at that, right? The US sitting there going, yeah, we've got an inflation targeting mandate, but actually we've also got an economic stability mandate. We are petrified about a kind of the recession that's kind of potentially coming. We see a recession as the worst of two worlds. And so therefore we think people are better off if we protect against a recession, acknowledging that that might drive higher inflation. I would argue the US Fed is probably more in the real world. We're more in the intellectual world.
More in the intellectual world, yeah?
Yeah, where we're kind of going for this perfection of we want to stay being still be known as the central bank that kind of fights inflation and kind of having that reputation. I don't know. It's the only thing that I can really, conclusion I can come to, because otherwise, shouldn't we be looking at kind of like a 75 basis point cut here in New Zealand next week or in the next month?
Yeah, well, to be honest, like I think I'm very much in this 50 point cut camp for October. What's that, sorry?
I'd go more than 50, to be honest, looking at the data set.
Oh, yeah. See, even I thought I was bold for suggesting 50 points, but it kind of feels, and maybe this is the same reasoning for you, but my thinking was that based on government shrinking, like there's a school of thought that says that government actually, you know, government spending doesn't even influence CPI. So that is a thought that's out there, right? But I kind of think, well, no, probably not. And if they shrink back, it's kind of like you have two parents, and if one is being the jellyfish parent and they're not being very strict, then the other parent kind of has to overreact. And it kind of feels like in New Zealand, we've had a very strict parent pulling back government spending, slashes everywhere. There's obviously less money being injected into the economy as a result, would be my deduction from that. And as a result, it kind of creates that space where the Reserve Bank could be a little bit more dovey-dovey and a little hockey, a little less hockey-hockey, and kind of just chill a little bit, right? Because it feels like we went harder, faster, sooner, and probably dealt with the underlying problem a lot quicker than maybe even what the Reserve Bank can see yet. And it kind of feels like everywhere I look anyway, there are signs of economic downturn. 0.2% reduction in GDP is the official stat. But I look at restaurants that are closing down. I hear people that are losing their jobs. I don't see a soft landing in sight yet. And so, yeah, like I would love to see a 0.75% reduction. I don't see it because of the credibility piece. But maybe that's what's coming. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, look, I unfortunately, I agree with you. I think that it will be, they won't go that far, but I do think the data kind of suggests that we should be at that level, if not higher, right? Because you are right, it's a desperation factor when you get what's happening at the moment where the government is having to pull people back to the city so that restaurants can survive, right? Like, come on, that's not a sustainable growth strategy or productivity strategy. That's just desperation.
And I think, unfortunately, we're probably going to see desperation in terms of policy setting soon if they don't actually act swiftly enough, right? Yeah. So, yeah, so you kind of think, for all intents and purposes, we're probably not going to see a 0.25% cut. It's almost a certainty it's going to be 0.5, and they probably should do 0.75?
I would like to see 0.75. I think the New Zealand economy is really struggling. We've got record liquidations happening. We've got unemployment going up. We've got immigration, which has come to a stop. We're in the worst per capita depression or worst per capita recession since basically the very early, in a worse recession than the one that we had in the very early 1990s with the mother of all budgets. I mean, our economy has some issues, right? And I think it's really, really hard. It's kind of, do they focus on really just making sure they've slain inflation? Or do we focus on getting people back on their feet? And I'd probably rather let's get the growth back. Let's get the economy back rolling. Everyone hates a recession. This is particularly an engineered recession, and we can fix that pretty quickly. And then if we need to adjust our settings later to fight inflation, we can go back to doing that. But there doesn't seem to be huge rationale for the policy settings of where we are, except for the intellectual reasons.
What does this say about credibility? Obviously, we want to make sure, or we would like there to be respect for the office of the central bank. When they say something, we want them to follow through. We want them to be seen, at the very least, to be looking like they're accurately and confidently taking control of the economy, right? But when they do moves like this, it can kind of imply that they're not really in control. So from a credibility point of view, do you think that we have some concerns here because of these wild swings?
I would actually change that conversation. Do we think they lose credibility by pretending to have it under control? So by that, what I mean is actually, that's why I think the conversation around the 25-point cut back in August was so wrong, because in my mind, actually, I thought that was great because that demonstrated that they are willing to look at the data as it flows. They are willing to keep on changing and kind of reflecting upon what they're doing. I think actually, if the economy keeps on kind of traversing in a slightly worse trajectory, it actually, if anything, shows that they're willing to look at the data, they're willing to read that data, and they care about real people versus the intellectual philosophies that they're adhering to.
Okay. That's interesting. Meanwhile, on the topic of credibility, this is a bit of a leap for me to segue into this one, but on the topic of credibility, we have BlackRock going all in on crypto. There's an approval of options trading now. There's a lot more stuff. Like I read this paper. I think you might have sent it through. Yeah. This BlackRock paper that was sent through to me. I think you sent it through. Yeah. Just reading that, it kind of made it sound like BlackRock actually understand kind of what's going on. They're speculating that Bitcoin is actually a hedge for systemic concerns, basically.
Yeah.
And found that quite interesting. And it kind of feels so opposite to where we've been. It makes me wonder, maybe it's not as bad as what I thought in terms of traditional finance being so anti-Bitcoin. It really does feel like they've adopted it with open arms. It really feels like there's going to be this Bitcoin summer coming up that feels like it's delayed a little bit. But what's your general feeling around BlackRock? And do you feel like this is going to spread to other large fund managers and we're going to see a change to pretty much every fund, including Bitcoin, in an allocation?
Now, look, I think it's getting harder and harder to ignore it is the short answer. BlackRock, it's kind of interesting how far into it they've gone. Not only did they launch the ETFs, but now these research papers where they're talking about how and why it should be a part of a portfolio. Gap between Bitcoin and gold is getting smaller and smaller. And The Economist has written a piece last week talking about how the kind of the growth in money and the transition of money from silver to base metals to kind of the impact of that, and actually the analogies with where we're at in crypto as well. So it is really, really interesting. I think the honest truth is the moment that a firm like BlackRock gets in behind it, the kind of the genie's out of the bottle. They manage about $5 trillion of assets under management on their own. And so just them staying, cool, I'm going to start putting a little bit in some of our core portfolios and some of our funds, it makes a huge difference. And that also gives people the ear cover to go and do the same, because everyone says, well, hey, BlackRock are doing it. If BlackRock have got the research, they've got the theory, they've kind of got probably the smartest portfolio theorists in the world working for them.
What I found interesting about that paper is that they refer to it more than once, an asset which isn't correlated to traditional mainstream assets. Ultimately, that's like the holy grail, right? Like if you're building a fund, you want to have ziggers for all your zaggers. You want to make sure that there's some continuity in terms of your returns, and made that quite clear that this is an uncorrelated asset. And I think like kudos to you guys for inserting that into your KiwiSaver portfolios, because you guys were doing it before BlackRock, which is pretty cool, right?
Like BlackRock copied me.
Exactly. Let's go with that one. So let's talk about China now as well. And there's a lot going on in China. Always really hard to know. It's going to be around the property issue, but also the central bank is doing some really interesting things. I was doing a bit of research around this one. Found it really fascinating just to learn that even the Russian Federation, PBOC, the People's Bank of China. Yeah. And pretty much every other central bank in the world, they're all kind of networked together. Bank of International Settlements, BIS, they are all kind of under that umbrella. Obviously, they're the Russian Federation. They're in a little bit of hot water at the moment, but I just found it really interesting because they all have acronyms, three-letter acronyms. They have, it has MLF, Mothers, no, hang on, not that one. EM term lending, or what, I can't remember what it's called, but they have all these things, kind of like the OCR. They all have their versions of it where they're triple R, right? So reserve ratio requirements. So that they have these settings that they can adjust, they can expand the amount of seed money, I guess you could say, that banks have so that they can lend more or less, and they can influence the interest rate, really similar to how it works with every other central bank. But they have been easing over the past little while to little positive effect, it seems. And I guess speculation is rising that they're going to pull out some bigger guns. I don't know what they would be, but I want to know, like, from your perspective, does this say more about how bad the Chinese economy really is, or how effective the central bank is in trying to stimulate the economy?
So I think the two things are the same. A question, right? I think you've also forgotten about the politics. So you've got to remember that, like, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the New Zealand economy over the last 5 years has been driven by, or the last 15 years has been driven by government spending and immigrants. We've cut those three things off, and lo and behold, our economy's struggling and we've got nothing left. Chinese economy over the last kind of probably the better part of the last 15, 20 years has been built on leverage. And whether that's combination of leverage and property. Leverage, property, and manufacturing. Manufacturing is kind of there, but getting a lot harder because of the tariffs that have kind of been coming in. And also the political problems that kind of we have here. You've got the leverage issue, and this is a massive one, right? So the last kind of, it's been acknowledged for the better part of the last 3 or 4 years that leverage in the Chinese economy is way too high. And it's not leverage at the state level, it's actually leverage at the provincial level. So individual cities that have gone and borrowed a huge amount to build infrastructure or actually to do property developments, more to the point. You've got companies that are massively over leveraged, the likes of an Evergrande, which is going to be one of the largest bankruptcies we see this decade. There's a lot of those kind of zombie companies sitting there that have just had easy access to debt through the Chinese state banks. So there's been a massive path of deleveraging through the economy over the last kind of 4 or 5 years. It smacked up the property market because this property market has been reliant on this cheap, easy flows of money. So you've got political stuff that's there. You've got a deleveraging impact, which is pretty strong to de-risk the economy, which is then hitting the property market. And so I'd actually argue the central bank can do whatever they want. Unless they're willing to change central government policies and get back on the old gravy train, it's going to be really, really hard for them to do this, right? Because until they can kiss and make up with the US, which means that gets rid of the tariffs and kind of makes their manufacturing sector strong again, until they can just say to the provinces and the town and the property developers, actually, off you go, here's a whole lot of money to finish your projects and go nuts. Until they start welcoming immigration to kind of move away from this whole property, this whole kind of property and population reduction, there's actually not a huge amount that can be done, right? I think what's interesting is you can see over the last probably 3 or 4 weeks, Chinese government is throwing more and more at it, dropping central banks, getting different people to kind of give different briefings, trying to bring more certainty to the market. But the reaction from everyday Chinese, well, as reported by the Western media, which is who knows whether it's true or not, is, you know what, same shit, different day. It's not going to make any difference. And apparently everyday Chinese are also losing confidence in the economy as well.
When you see that, when there's less confidence in the economy, it can actually be like a cancer from within. It's really hard to turn that ship around, right? I just want to go back around the, like, say the interest rate, Fed funds rate in the US, in China, I can't remember the name of it, but their equivalent version of that. You have the OCR here in New Zealand. Every time the interest rates are changed, one of the other dynamics that happens, which I think really interesting to always think about at the same time, cost of borrowing going down, is the impact that the interest rate or the relationship that the interest rate has with our exchange rate. And that's why I think there are some nuances to the conversation that we had earlier on, even around how far the official cash rate in New Zealand does go. Because as it goes down, our dollar effectively goes down as well, because money, like a moth to the flame, will always go towards where there's a relatively higher turn. So if that starts to happen, then it messes with our export earnings, right? So it kind of shifts the pain towards different parts of the economy. Even just like with interest rates falling, you're happy as the middle-aged, middle-class mortgage holder. Granny's taking a pay cut on her term deposits, right? And so when interest rates move around, there's all these dynamics that happen in parallel to just that number going. It makes it quite nuanced. And so tying that back into China, these major markets around the world, they do kind of all have to move in unison. I think Japan is the only one that's hiking, right? Everybody else is getting to fall and dropping even more. And I think it's kind of interesting just to see how that alignment, that synchronicity with central banks is probably stronger than ever, is my suspicion, except for Japan. But we're all kind of moving towards the same place almost. Do you have any thoughts on central bank synchronicity?
Yeah, well, I think there's two parts to it, right? I think the global economy is much more intertwined than it's ever been. And up until probably 2019, 2020, trade, I think, was at the highest level that it had been for almost 100 years, which is an interesting fact, actually. World War One was the period when it was similar kind of trading levels. So it took us 100 years to get back to that. Given the trade, given how interlinked the economies are, given where we've gone on supply chains and linking supply chain and all that kind of stuff together, they kind of have to move together. They do have to move in parallel, and particularly around the interest rate stuff, right? Exchange rate, you then have competition exchange rates, make sure you got lower exchange rate to support your exporters. Yeah, it is a tough one. I mean, the context that I'd give as well, though, is remember a couple of months ago, we were talking about domestic inflation and imported inflation.
Yeah.
And I think the general view had been that actually 2/3 of the inflation that we're seeing in New Zealand was imported. So I guess if we're importing inflation, everyone's importing inflation, the global economy means that those drivers are pretty fixed no matter where you are, right? Only thing that really diverges between economies now, I think, is the cost of labor.
It's just interesting, eh? Like we're living in more of a deglobalized world in a sense, but that monetary level still very, very interconnected.
Yeah, but we've also got to remember what we've been through, right? And I think this is what quite a few of the market commentators in the US are talking about, right? We still have a world where the last 4 years is anything but normal, right? We had COVID, the COVID shutdown, that happened and that hit the entire globe. We then had the massive stimulus that every single country in the world did, right? So we started this move in parallel. We then had money flooding. We had supply chains. And so I think the synchronicity probably started 4 or 5 years ago around that COVID time. And it's going to take us a long time to unwind out of that world, right? Arguably, and I'm not an economist, but I would argue that actually when we move to neutral, and whether that's kind of 3% or 4%, I don't know what the new neutral is. I don't think we're going to be out of the synchronicity until we get to the end of this current cycle, right? Because I think we are all responding to the same set of kind of dynamics over the last 4 or 5 years.
Worldwide event catalyst that begins the new synchronicity. Yeah. Time will tell, right? But over the long term, you'd like to see that there's some variance. I know that it does make it easier, though, just from a central planning point of view, to have everything moving in the same vein, though, as well. Okay, let's bring it back to New Zealand, because we've seen with Auckland International Airport there, and some other ones that I'm not aware of, there's a bit more capital raising going on. And a lot of reasons why you might want to raise capital, pay down debt, fund expansion, all that sort of stuff. So why don't you give us a lowdown, though, on, say, Auckland International Airport first, and maybe if we have time, we'll get stuck into Fletcher's.
Yeah, look, I thought it was really interesting, right? New Zealand capital markets has been pretty dead for the last 3 or 4 years. And in the last 2 weeks, we've seen some of the largest kind of capital raises that we've ever seen in New Zealand. So Auckland Airport, they announced a $1.4 billion capital raise last week to fund an expansion of the airport. They're doing a massive redevelopment of the domestic terminal and linking it into the international terminal. Admittedly, the more money they spend on capital, the more money they're allowed to charge airlines. So the goal when you're an airport is dig as many fucking holes as you can. And this is them raising some money to go and do that, right? What I found interesting, and then Fletcher's, they announced on Monday, they're doing a $700 million capital raise to pay down debt. Again, a business which has been atrociously managed for the better part of, well, let's call it 40 years. And they've either got two options. Can either sell assets and the bottom of the market in a kind of a really tough time, or they can raise some money from their shareholders to kind of allow them to hold on and potentially sell these assets at a better time because they got way too much debt. What I thought was interesting is the structure of these, and I saw a lot of comments on Sharesies and others, which is actually really interesting, right? Because they're done as, so Auckland Airport was done as an institutional offer. Plus, and so it's done a big institutional offer. So I think it was about $1.2 billion institutional offer, which means it got sent out to institutions like us, like others in the market. It was really interesting that Sharesies actually got an allocation into that offer as well, and they offered some of their clients. And then there was also the share purchase plan, the SPP, which was a part of it. If you're currently a shareholder in Auckland Airport, you were able to go and buy up to $150,000 worth of shares at a ratio, I think it was 4.1 to 1, or I can't remember the exact number, but it's interesting, right? So us as institutions, so here at Kōrā, we were able to bid into the big $1.2 billion pot, whereas as retail holders, which many of you will be, you are able, and if you are currently a shareholder, you're able to bid to that share purchase plan. Fletcher's, slightly different. Fletcher's was an underwritten rights issue, which basically meant that new investors weren't that keen to go and support the business, and new investors, they couldn't find any new big investors to go in to do that. So what they did is they kind of offered shares through to each of the existing shareholders. So it was an institutional rights issue, plus also a share purchase plan as well that came through as well. So interesting mechanics, good reasons for it. I think it's great. It shows that there's light in the New Zealand market. And for those of you that are investing through Sharesies, other ways that you're investing in the New Zealand market, hopefully you've been able to get the documentation, you've been able to participate and have a look. One thing just to counsel anyone as they're looking at this and thinking about it, just because it's cheaper than it was 3 months ago, does not mean that it's a good buy. A lot of people made that mistake in COVID, particularly around Air New Zealand and some of those companies where they went, 60 cent rights issue, when it was previously trading at kind of $1.20, that's cheap as. It's now trading at 50 cents. So just be careful if you are going to participate in these things. Just because they're offering that price at a discount doesn't mean that it's a good buy.
And so, like, on that, When you think about the investors who are existing investors in either Fletcher's or Air New Zealand, it's not Air New Zealand, Auckland International Airport, they're effectively issuing more shares as part of this process. Yeah. So as it relates to investors who don't, like existing investors who don't take action, walk me through what the implications are there.
Look, if you don't take action, then effectively you're diluted. So at a real simple story, if there are 100 shares issued in a company and they do a capital raise for that and issue another 10 shares, all of a sudden you've gone from having, I used to have 10 of those shares. Previously I had 10 out of 100, so I own 10% of the company, which means I was eligible for 10% of the profits that would come back. I've issued another 10 shares, so now there are 110 shares in the company. I still only own my 10, so therefore I only own 9% of the company, and therefore I'm only eligible to receive 9% of the dividends and 9% of the profit. So sure, that's the dilution impact. Again, don't necessarily worry about the dilution impact. You look at an issue like an Auckland Airport, that's to fund growth, right? That's expansion capital. That's an investment to kind of basically allow them to build a massive new terminal, which they can then charge airlines a whole lot of money, which the airlines then charge their passengers. Travel's about to get a whole lot more expensive for all of us. Mm. But means that that's kind of growth. So even though you've been diluted, the theory is that actually the pot will get a whole lot bigger, so your 9% gets a whole lot more.
Yeah.
It's slightly harder to see. The argument is that actually, because it's not growth capital, it's been used to pay down debt, that's been used to kind of strengthen the balance sheet. The argument is that without that, just by the strengthening of the balance sheet on its own, creates a whole lot of extra value and gets rid of a whole lot of uncertainty that would otherwise be there. So yeah, it's a hard one, right? Being diluted in its own right isn't necessarily a bad thing. Just being aware of why you're being diluted, and you should not participate just from fear of dilution either.
Totally, because like you can kind of see
you need to look at it as its own independent investment decision, right? If you're kind of thinking about it going, hey, look, at $6.95 for Auckland Airport, am I happy buying more shares? Do I think that's a good deal? And basically when you're looking at it through your different lenses, right? Or $2.95, or I think $2.50 actually for Fletcher's. But yeah, that's the one thing you've got to think about, right? Just because it's cheap or just because you're going to be diluted, it's not the reason to do it. You're doing it because you think it's a good investment at that price.
It's an important reminder, eh? Like every time you're parting with money and you're putting it into some sort of investment, is an investment decision. Is you're never put into that situation where you have to respond automatically without thinking. But the other thing, like, I think that's important, just, and you did say this, but just to really emphasize that, is that if you didn't participate in this, you're being diluted, and it's probably just a function of time. Like if they're doing that and they're expanding things, they're going to be more profitable, they're going to be worth more anyway. So even though you have less shares, theory they should be worth more. And hey, if you didn't participate, you just saved yourself the money. So over the medium to long term, if it's actually a good thing, you should be all right. Whereas yeah, like with the Fletcher's one, I guess it's probably a case of just reducing the likelihood that the share price could fall further, right? Because they are, you know, 10 to 15% down in terms of turnover or profit. I can't remember which one it was, but clearly we're you know, struggling. They're in an environment which is pulling back in that scene as well. So they have to do what they can, buckle down the hatches, get ready for what comes next, right? So that makes sense. Yeah, that's cool. In New Zealand, is there any other news that's happening right now in New Zealand that we should be mindful of? I don't think so. Hey, like there's obviously a lot of little things going on, but there's not really a lot happening in New Zealand apart from everyone's leaving, right?
Oh, look, yeah, nothing to be mindful of. I think our government has shown yet again how to be a great populist government with their announcements yesterday on working from home. Peter Duplessis wrote a nice article on the weekend, and then Nicola Willis is talking from the podium about it the next day. So clearly shows who's really making policy here in New Zealand. But yeah, there's nothing too interesting going on, unfortunately. I think we all just need to be bated breath waiting for that interest rate call, seeing where it comes out.
Yeah, no, that's good. Okay, cool. All right, well, we covered a bit of ground today. Next week, let's pick up on a few stories around the Bitcoin one in particular. There is this, I haven't done enough research on it, but to do with options, trading, selling covered calls. I want to kind of dig into that a little bit more. I don't know if you have space for that or not, but that would be one thing I want to talk about. But yeah, there's a few things happening overseas that I would like to dig into more. So maybe next week. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Rupert. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks, Darcy. We'll speak next week.